From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. They can be sloppy, friendly, and delicious. Today we talk about those lovable and succulent creatures, pigs. One historian details our complicated relationship with them. First, we talked about Southern accents and dialects recently. Linguist Dennis Preston of Oklahoma State University says the way Southerners talk is changing.
I'm a really old guy from Louisville, Kentucky, and I love to distinguish between which and which. But if you look at recent surveys, you'll see that there's just a handful of us guys left. So if you want to sound anything like a Southerner, don't go around practicing your which, because there are very, very few Southerners left who have this distinction.
Here are your first thoughts.
Hello, this is Elbert Lewis from Millen, Georgia. I wanted to point out to you, the way you can determine Southern accent here in this area is when you talk about tomatoes. Here you got maters, maters, or tomatoes. Now, where we get a D in tomato, I don't know, but some folks call it tomatoes.
My name is Laura Messina. I noticed in the beginning of this broadcast talking about Southern accents, Celeste had mentioned people saying soda or pop. But if you are a native Atlantan, as I am and as my parents are, we just say Coke. Everything's a Coke. Do you want a Coke? Okay, what kind?
On Twitter, listener Neil Cassidy wrote, would not yes'm be a contraction of yes ma'am? We also talked about movies and TV in Georgia and about your favorite actor from our state. Sean Ryder emails his vote, best actress, Holly Hunter, best actor, Lawrence Fishburne. We always love to get your thoughts, and you can call us like Albert and Laura did at 404-500-9457, tweet us like Neil did at OST Talk, or email us, and we might feature your comments on the show. As natural predators of insects, bats are very important to agriculture. Researchers estimate their value to farmers in the U.S. at roughly $23 billion a year. But these are tough times for bats. A malignant fungus known as white nose syndrome has killed a lot of them over the past 10 years. This year, total bat numbers in surveyed areas of the state were down 94% from their highest previous counts. My colleague Adam Ragusa learned more about white nose syndrome from wildlife pathologist Heather Fenton of the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study. Adam also spoke with Georgia State University microbiologist Chris Cornelson.
Chris, just tell us, what makes this fungus, this white nose syndrome, so particularly dangerous to bats?
Well, it's particularly dangerous to North American species, and specifically hibernating species. There's a couple of reasons why it's so damaging. One is that it's an invasive species. It was introduced in the United States somewhere in the mid-2000s, likely from Europe or more recently Asia. And so the bats in North America have not co-evolved with this pathogen. They have not lived in an ecosystem where this pathogen persisted, and so they have not developed natural defenses against it. Additionally, fungi are generally more virulent or devastating as pathogens because they are known to be saprophytic. That is, they can live in a habitat without the host on which they cause disease. So the pathogen that causes white nose syndrome will persist in caves when all the bats are wiped out. So there's no balance or counterbalance, if you will, to that pathogen burning through this population.
Yeah, you can't quell the outbreak by simply eliminating or culling a population. You'd have to go in and scrub the cave with Clorox or something. Which obviously not going to be practical. Heather, remind us why we should care. Tell us a little bit about why bats are important to the ecosystem and to humans' involvement in the ecosystem.
Yeah, so as you mentioned before, they're incredibly important as pest control to the agricultural industry. So there's estimates that agricultural industries will have to use more pesticides if bat populations are eliminated, as well as they're really important pollinators for a number of crops. So they're doing this free service for us, and they're often maybe not thought of as doing this important service, but they're also important parts of the ecosystem in general. They're contributing to biodiversity. There's animals that eat bats, so owls, raccoons, skunks, and a number of other raptors like hawks will eat owls. Their poop, which is guano, is important to cave ecosystems. There's other microorganisms and then other animals sort of up the food chain that are really dependent on these ecosystems. So they're definitely an invaluable part to the ecosystem and to us. And there's some places where bats are obviously consuming insects, and insects can potentially carry pathogens that are harmful to people. So there's numerous ways where bats are important to us, even though we might not think about it.
Heather, how dire is the situation? White nose syndrome was first identified outside of Albany, New York. How bad has it impacted the bat populations in that epicenter?
Yeah, so there's a lot of folks that think that this is the worst or one of the worst wildlife diseases to hit North America. It's estimated that between 6 and 7 million bats have died from this fungus infection. There's caves where the mortality rate in each cave has been between 90 and 100%. Of those hibernating bat species that had lived in that cave. So there's been an extremely drastic reduction in bat numbers in affected areas, especially within the eastern North America.
And Chris, what's the situation looking like in Georgia? I mean, I remember it made rather minor news when white nose syndrome was first identified, I think, in North Georgia in 2013. I had recently moved to Georgia from Massachusetts, where the brown bat population has been decimated. So I noted that news item with great interest, and I thought, oh boy, what's been the result over the last two and a half years? How deeply has white nose syndrome impacted bat populations here in Georgia?
Unfortunately, Georgia has stuck with the trend we've seen throughout the East Coast. And recently, surveys are indicating that we're probably about 95% population declines in our most heavily affected species. And one example I can give you is recently I was able to go out with Department of Natural Resources to a survey to a site that historically was home to over 5,000 tricolor bats. During the survey, we counted a little over 200.
A little over, from 5,000 to 200.
Yeah, in 3 years.
That's stunning. So what makes this fungus so deadly? You touched on this earlier, but help me understand this a little bit more. In fact, let me play a clip here that's going to maybe give us a little bit of background. This is Craig Stiller of the West Virginia Department of Natural Resources, and he's talking about his opinion that as long as bats continue to hibernate, there will always be a risk of white nose syndrome. Let's listen.
Their body temperature is up, their immune system's going, they can fight off the fungus, but there doesn't seem to be any immunity. When they go back into hibernation again, they're just as likely to get white nose. And for as long as we have the right conditions, cold caves with hibernating bats, there doesn't seem to be anything that's going to stop this from spreading.
So Heather, is that right? Is there really no way to break out of this cycle for the bats?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an active area of research. So one of the reasons is that it's affecting hibernating bats is because it's a psychrophilic fungus, so it's a cold-loving fungus. It does really well in cold and humid environments.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why we think that maybe it's having this major impact. Another reason, as Chris has already mentioned, is that it is an introduced pathogen. So the thoughts are that bats within North America haven't had time to adapt to this fungus, like some bats have in Europe or Asia. So one of the other things that people should remember is that bat wings are incredibly important to bats. So we don't always think about how complicated physiologically their wings are, but they actually can breathe through their wings. They use their wings for temperature regulation as well as water balance, ion balance. So when there's a disruption of the wing membrane, which results from infection with this fungus, there's disruption in their water balance, so they become incredibly dehydrated. It's sort of similar to having really bad case of vomiting, of diarrhea in terms of the ion imbalance that happens.
Yeah.
And as well as just alterations in their metabolism in general. So what happens is that they wake up more often when they're hibernating, and then they're using energy stores and potentially emerging from caves before they're really supposed to. And then there's potentially no food around for them to be able to eat. So it's a really multifactorial process, and I think that's what's made it very complicated to try to understand, because it's not necessarily one thing that's going on. It's this multitude of factors.
We're talking to microbiologist Chris Cornelson and wildlife pathologist Heather Fenton about the spread of white nose syndrome into the southeast and into Georgia, where it is decimating bat populations that are vital to agriculture, among other aspects of ecological life. Chris, surely there are some responses underway, or at least in development, to save the bats. What are you guys working on?
Sure. There are a number of groups around the country working on management tools. And at Georgia State, we're working on a couple ourselves. And we've had some very positive preliminary results, and we're continuing to follow up with those with our partners and various federal agencies and state governments. As you mentioned earlier, the cave ecosystem, or the subterranean ecosystem these bats inhabit, is really unique. And so there's some additional concerns regarding development of tools. When you're talking about just scrubbing the cave with Clorox, right, that would be impractical, because we know that Clorox is sort of a broad-spectrum antimicrobial. It's going to have effects on all sorts of microorganisms and other organisms that inhabit these systems. So you don't want to disturb that ecosystem. So you want something that's very targeted towards this pathogen. And so that takes a little bit more creative thinking and a bit more of a challenge in the developmental stages. So a lot of
groups... There's no antifungal agent that you could introduce?
So there are some concepts that we're working on. For example, there are bacteria that are known to compete with fungi in the environment for resources. And at Georgia State, we're working on trying to leverage these naturally evolved systems to be applied in cave systems to target the pathogen, but hopefully have a less impact on the rest of the resident microflora in that cave. There's additional research into something like a vaccine, or the concept of gene silencing that's going on. But those are more theoretical at this point in regards to management of white nose syndrome, and a bit out on the horizon. So one of our goals in the immediate future is sort of stopgap management tools. Because like we talked about, if you're having 95% declines in 3 years, you don't have a lot of time to develop some more sophisticated approaches, and by the time those more sophisticated tools become available, there may not be any bats left to treat. So our immediate goal right now is to try and scale up some initial management tools that can be used to prevent these massive population declines, with the goal of providing more time for these more long-term solutions to be developed.
That's Georgia State University microbiologist Chris Cornelson speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusea. We also heard from wildlife pathologist Heather Fenton. She's with the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study. Just ahead, Georgia farmers are not happy with the state's pig population. But first, music legend Wayne Kramer prepares to rock out in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. This week, a rock guitar legend comes to Georgia. Wayne Kramer co-founded the Detroit band Motor City 5 back in 1967. You may remember this hit, Kick Out the Jams, from 1969. The group, also known as MC5, ultimately disbanded in 1973. But Wayne continued playing and has remained a politically vocal artist. He'll be in Georgia this week performing a benefit concert for Athens area veterans. Wayne Kramer joins me now. Hi there.
Thanks for the opportunity to blab on the radio.
I Rolling Stone named you one of the top 100 guitarists of all time. So how does that happen? I mean, can you point to the things that you did to become so good on the guitar?
Yeah, I practiced a lot.
No getting around it, huh?
Yes, there's no getting. Malcolm Gladwell was right. You've got to put in the 10,000 hours. I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours listening to records and trying to figure out what other guitar players were playing.
And I wonder, I mean, you've done so many things, and besides just the music, which is an enormous catalog, but you worked as a carpenter for a while. You obviously spent a little bit of time in prison. You launched your own label. And I wonder how you think that may have changed you as a musician. I mean, as compared to, say, somebody like The Edge, who plays with the same band for 30, 40 years or whatever it is. How does it change if you're somebody who does all kinds of different stuff?
Good question. How does it change? You know, I made all my own misfortune, and I created all my own trouble. Maybe The Edge was just wiser and didn't turn left when he should have turned right. You know, it might have been nice to not have to go through everything I did, but I did. And you know, the way I see it, the things that I've been through are really my greatest gifts. They're the things that I can turn to when I say I'm talking with someone else and they're facing a challenge that maybe I've faced, that I could say the one thing that no one else can say, which is, I know how you feel. I did that too.
Well, that brings us to one of your projects, which is the Jail Guitar Doors project.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you see that project functioning? Is giving people an opportunity to feel as though they're not unique in making mistakes, or what's the mission?
Well, the mission is pretty simple. We find people that work in corrections, that work in prisons and jails, that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation. And we provide them with instruments and programming in the form of songwriting workshops. So if I can put a guitar in a man or a woman or a boy's hand and task him with writing a song, maybe to his mom or to his son or to himself, about how he got there and what might he do to make sure he never comes back to these places, and then have him perform that song for his fellows, it's transformative. They begin to see themselves as more than a crime or a bed space or a loser or a number, and start to see themselves as an artist, as someone who can contribute something to the world of beauty. And I think it can be the first step in the hard work of positive change.
Why is music the right vehicle for that? For I guess you're talking about like self-empowerment.
Yeah, and self-expression. And music is just one of any of the arts. You know, theater will do this. Painting will do it. Writing will do it. Poetry does it. Dance will do it. I know a guy, he's a sheriff's deputy in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and he told me once, Wayne, if I educate a criminal, I have an educated criminal. What it takes is a change on a deeper level, a fundamental change of heart. And the only thing that we know that really can reach people on that deep level is the arts and organized sports. Strangely enough, the arts do is put us in touch with our humanity.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with guitarist and MC5 co-founder Wayne Kramer. Let's go back to the days of the MC5, because I want to fact check a story I heard, which was that Shaken Street, that song, which is kind of a different sound from what you know you're used to from the MC5. I was told that it was actually Springsteen's manager, John Landau, that demanded you guys put it on the album even though you didn't want to. Is that story true?
No.
So he's just out bragging for something. No, no inkling of that. You guys never resisted putting it on the album.
No, it was one of our best songs. Why? No, that's an interesting tale. I've never heard that one before. No,
well,
and John Landau was a huge fan of the song and of the band. And no, I don't. No, that never happened.
Okay. Well, then let's talk a little bit about where we are in the music business. And especially, you know, we just got word this year that for the first time, rock and roll was dethroned, right? Hip hop outsold rock and roll for the first time. Sure. And I wonder what you think about that. Is sort of straight up rock on the way out?
Could be. I mean, you know, every generation has to find its own voice. And its own music and its own art, and it has to break away from the previous generation, and that's what my generation did with rock and roll, and even, you know, breaking away from early rock and roll into the rock of the 70s and 80s, and now, you know, we're in a new time, and it's a new generation, and. So this is just the natural order of things.
But do you find things in the hip hop genre or R&B genre that you can use, or is it a totally different sort of form of the art?
Oh, it's all, you know, when you're talking about music and you know, combining melodies and lyrics and music, it's all in play. So, you know, there's things that people are doing in hip hop that, you know, absolutely come from other areas, rock and who knows, Lithuanian reggae music. You know, it's all in the mix now.
This is Back in Detroit from the 1996 solo record Dangerous Madness, and you actually rebooted that album just a few years ago. Let's hear a little bit of Back in Detroit.
It's a hard wind that blows through the building. It's the corner of Michigan and 31st wakes in ruin. And the echoes of the happy shoppers faded long, long, long ago. Back when Chrysler, GM, and Ford went mad with greed.
What connection do you still feel to Detroit? Because I want to just reveal to my listeners that when I told them Detroit was my favorite city, you accused me of being mentally ill. So what connection do you still feel to the Motor City?
Well, I have a deep and complex relationship with Detroit. I was born and raised there and lived through Detroit's most prosperous period and when all things were possible, and it was the greatest manufacturing center in the world, and then I had great personal triumphs and success there, and then I also crashed and burned badly there, and ended up in trouble with the police and being sent to prison. And then I watched the city kind of mirror my own personal downward spiral. When I was living there, it was the fifth largest city in America, and 1.5 million, maybe 2 million people in the city, and another 2 or 3 million in the suburbs. And today there's less than 700,000 people in the city of Detroit. It's like, the American Pompeii. It's entire neighborhoods that I grew up in that are gone. They don't exist anymore. It's Katrina-level destruction. And it's heartbreaking to go back and you know, I still have a great many friends and a little bit of family there, and I admire them and I appreciate the effort that they're putting in to try to sustain. I mean, maybe Detroit could be Portland one day, but it'll never be the Detroit of my youth. And you know, that's a sad commentary on capitalism, really. You know, that these giant corporations came in and you know, made billions and billions of dollars in profit, and then when the world around them changed, they didn't adjust, and then they just moved out, and they leave a city of leftover workers and no jobs. And you know, this is the trouble with capitalism. It puts profit ahead of people.
Well, let's go back to your musical influence, although I'm not sure we can separate musical influence from political influence. But let's hear a song about you that was written by The Clash. This is Jail Guitar Doors. So, I mean, that is years old, but you must meet people all the time who point to you as one of their main influences. You and the MC5 and the music coming out of the time that you guys were playing. Did you have any inkling in 1967, 1970, that all these years later, people would still be listening to your stuff and still be influenced by you?
In a way, you know, we used to talk about the music we were creating and kind of run it through a filter of, was this idea historically valid? In other words, would it sustain over time, or was this just a momentary fad? So I tried to always think in terms of style and not fashion. Fashion comes and goes, changes all the time, but style is eternal.
But that suggests that you may have tossed stuff out that didn't meet that standard.
Of course.
A lot?
It happened. I mean, you know, you always have to make decisions about, is this a good idea or is this not a good idea? And we had a lot of you know, intense conversations about, you know, let's do this lyric. No, I don't like that lyric. That lyric, no, that doesn't make any sense. No, that's temporary, you know.
So how is that different? The process of playing with bands and writing your own stuff, or how is that different, do you think, musically, from the process of scoring movies or TV shows? I mean, you've done a lot of work with Will Ferrell movies. You scored the documentary Hacking Democracy, which was so controversial on HBO, and the TV show Eastbound and Down, I think that was yours. Yeah.
Yep.
How's that musical process different from playing in a band?
Couldn't be more different. It's two entirely different skill sets. Because if I want to make a record, I write some songs and I call up my friends and we all go in the studio and we record the record and we mix it and voila, there's my record. But when I'm scoring, I work for the director or the showrunner. And my job is to help them tell their story their way. It's not my music, it's not my ideas, it's their music, it's their ideas. And my job is to apply what I know about music to help them do that. It's way more challenging than playing in a band, because you work for somebody, and that somebody has absolute control. I mean, I've had directors say, "Wayne, we love what you just wrote. It's really great. I think it's perfect, but could you change the beginning, the end, and the middle? And my job is to say, yes, sir, I'm on it right now. I'm getting it done.
How, but you still
how
enjoy
exactly?
It?
Of course. Of course. It's, the collaboration is the best part of the work.
Okay, Wayne Kramer is guitarist and co-founder of the Detroit band, the MC5. He will perform at CBGB Athens. It's a benefit for Athens area veterans. That's this Saturday at 7 p.m. Wayne, thank you so much. Thanks for coming to Georgia, and thanks for playing here.
Thanks.
Just ahead, a taste of Georgia's craft chocolate industry. But first, our complicated relationship with pigs. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk about how college debt is taking a toll on Georgia. And we want to hear from you. Are you still paying off your college loans? Call us at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Twitter. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Pigs are a huge part of Georgia's economy, but they can also cause a lot of problems. A University of Georgia report last year says feral swine caused nearly $99 million in crop damage and $51 million in non-crop damage. That's in 2014. That doesn't mean we should hate these animals, though. Historian Mark Essig says our relationship with pigs is a complicated one. Essig is the author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. I spoke to him earlier this year.
The thing about pigs is that they breed really quickly. A cow will gestate for 9 months and give you one calf, maybe two. A goat for 5 months and give you a couple of kids, maybe three. But a pig gestates for just about 4 months and will give you maybe a dozen piglets, and each of those will start breeding within a year. So if you want to build up a herd very quickly, you want pigs. That's been good for people who want to eat them, not so good for game wardens and golf course managers who want to keep them from destroying crops and turf.
I didn't even think about golf courses, but are these wild pigs in states like Georgia and other southern states that you mentioned, did they used to be domesticated?
For the most part, they are feral pigs. There's a few pockets of true wild boar that escape from game parks, but almost all of them are former domestic pigs that have escaped into the wild and started doing their piggy thing, breeding and eating like crazy.
Okay, so why would they cause almost $100 million in damage? What are they doing that is so damaging?
For the most part, they are rooting. The pigs have this miraculous organ on the front of their face called a snout. It's really better to think of it as a shortened elephant's trunk rather than as a nose, because most of the pigs' senses, nerves related to touch are concentrated in the snout, which is also incredibly powerful. So it can get pretty much wherever it wants to be and eat wherever it wants. What's made the pigs so valuable over the course of the last 10,000 years or so that they've partnered with humans is that they are omnivores. They will eat just about everything humans eat and many things that they won't. So if you're growing a crop in the field, chances are the pig will be happy to eat it. If you're growing a crop under the ground, potatoes, tubers, the roots of many plants, pigs find those delicious too. And they have an exquisite sense of smell. If there's something edible, a pig's going to find it.
But one of the things, and you talk about this in your quite a bit in your book, the fact that they are omnivores has also been part of the problem with pigs and our relationship, because in many cases, when pigs have been banned, either by a country, by legal means, or because of a religion, it's been because of what they eat, right?
It's been because of what they eat. Yeah, the history of pig domestication is interesting because unlike goats, sheep, cows, where we think that they became domestic through the process of hunting, hunting turned into herding, turned into domestication, we think that pigs became domestic in much the way dogs did. As soon as people settle down into permanent villages, one of the things they do is start producing a lot of garbage. And the pigs and the dogs started lurking around town and eating that food. So gradually, the pigs that were best at this process, the wild boar that were best at that process, evolved in a true evolutionary process into what we call domestic pigs. That was a great advantage. You took something that you very much did not want, which was rotting food, other kinds of garbage, you turned it into something that you did want, which was meat and fat. So that's an amazing alchemical process. But it also associated them with filth, because they ate not only garbage, but also, say, human waste and some rather unsavory things. So they were thought of as filthy scavengers that polluted cities, polluted temples throughout the Near East, where the first pig prohibitions arose. Nobody ever sacrificed pigs to the gods. They were considered unclean, and anybody who was concerned about holiness and sacredness kept away from them.
Which is really not fair to the pig, right? Because it's what we were feeding them, that made them have such low opinions of them. It's like dressing your kid in awful clothing and then say they're a bad dresser. But the natural state of a pig is not filthy. I mean, pigs in their natural state are not filthy beasts. Isn't that right?
They're actually rather tidy. If you give pigs room to roam and enough material to build a nest out of, they build a fresh nest every night. When they wake up in the morning, they walk well away from the nest before doing their business. The one thing that has associated pigs with filth is that thermoregulation. They don't sweat if they want to cool. They need to take a nice bath in water.
They roll in mud.
Exactly.
Yeah, but they usually clean it off.
They will clean it off, and frankly, you can't blame them. The good Lord made pigs such that they needed to wallow to stay cool. We shouldn't hold that against them, should we?
And no, and there are plenty of animals actually that wallow in mud, including human beings. Go check Google images. There's plenty of mud events all over the country. I mean, I got to put up some defense for the humble pig here, because there are some low opinions. But on the other hand, pigs have been really important to humankind, and that's one of the reasons they're so important to the economy. And that is because A, they're delicious, and B, so many pieces of the pig are usable.
Yeah, there's some interesting studies coming out of ancient Rome where you find strange butchery cuts on the bones of pigs dating back a couple thousand years that suggested that people were carefully carving off every tasty morsel from the head of a pig, suggesting that they were really getting every bit of value. And that's always been the story of the pig. Not only do they breed quickly, not only do they produce a lot of meat, but all of that meat cures really well with salt. Unlike, say, pork or mutton, which turns to shoe leather when you cure it, pork gets better.
Wait, and you that's just said pork or mutton. What was the other? You're thinking of beef?
Oh, I'm sorry. Beef or mutton is what I meant. Forgive me. When you think of jerky, it's a very tough and leathery thing. When you think of ham or bacon, they only get more delicious with time. And we've really only had artificial refrigeration for the past 100, 125 years or so. Before that, if you wanted a meat supply to last, you had to cure it in salt. And that's one of the reasons that pork was so crucial, because it was the meat that preserved best in salt.
So I want to take us back to this report out of the University of Georgia, which launched this conversation. That's a report in which they tallied up numbers in 2014 and found that wild pigs in Georgia caused almost $99 million in crop damage and $51 million in non-crop damage. So that's the negative, the con side of that equation. But what are the pros? What exactly do pigs add to an ecosystem?
Most biologists would tell you not very much at all. They're mostly destructive. Pigs are not native to the New World. They were introduced on Columbus's second voyage. The one advantage that pigs have, that feral pigs have, is that people like to hunt them. And there have been some studies that suggested the reason that pigs are spreading so quickly, feral pigs are spreading so quickly and becoming such a problem, is not just that they breed quickly and reproduce, but that rather unethical hunters are actually carting them all around the South and releasing them because they want more opportunities to hunt.
We have to end the conversation there, although I bet we could keep it going. That's historian Mark Essig, author of the book Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Celeste.
All this year for our series Georgia Eats, we explore the South's relationship with food. We talked about the state's craft beer industry. Turns out there's also a craft chocolate movement, and it's taken some Georgia chocolatiers far beyond the state's borders. Elaine Reed and Matt Wyant are the creative force behind Atlanta-based Chocolatl, and they brought some samples. I spoke to them earlier this year about their quest to learn about chocolate in its purest forms.
We make chocolate from the bean, from the cacao bean, and into the finished chocolate bar at our little factory at Krog Street Market. And when we started, one of the things we knew we wanted to do was to try to directly source the cacao as much as possible. And so,
what does that mean to directly source?
So cacao grows within 20 degrees of the equator. So it does not grow in the United States except for Hawaii. So if you want to source cacao, where you actually buy it from the farmers who are growing it and harvesting it and doing the post-harvest process, it's this fermentation and drying process that happens, then you have to travel to countries where it grows. And so Peru is actually the Peruvian Amazon is the genetic birthplace of cacao, and then it spread from there up through Central America over to Africa, which is actually where the majority of cocoa is now grown for industrial chocolate, but all over the world. So we've traveled mostly to Central and South America to source our beans.
Let's actually take a listen to a little bit from the documentary Setting. The documentary is called Setting the Bar, a Craft Chocolate Origin Story. And here we hear from some of the chocolatiers, I guess, who went with you on this trip to the Amazon. The first voice we hear, though, is yours, Elaine.
It's almost like there is a wave, like a huge wave that's bearing down on cacao.
Well, this is what you get with good oxygenation.
That's looking really good.
We have this unique opportunity down here where cacao originated to aid in the attempt to preserve this genetic variety.
What did you mean a huge wave coming down on cacao?
That may sound a little bit dramatic, but there are some threats, potential threats to cacao and diversity in cacao. So if you look at it from a environmental point of view, we know that we are losing rainforest on a daily basis. The Amazon is, you know, daily we're losing rainforest due to agribusiness and other types of clear cutting. And as Matt mentioned, cacao grows in 20 degrees north and south of the equator, which puts you right in the Amazon. So the Amazon is a natural home to cacao. And as logging and other threats occur within the rainforest, one of the consequences of that is losing cacao. Additionally, we've got efforts to grow clones and to encourage farmers to plant different types of cacao clones, which on the one hand is good. It does help us to preserve some of the cacao varieties, the genetics that are out there. On the other hand, there is the threat when one particular type of clone gets planted in large quantities, and that actually ends up reducing the amount of diversity in the rainforest. And then additionally, we've got an increased global demand for chocolate. And with people becoming more and more educated on the health benefits and maybe preferences, taste trends changing over time, people are more and more interested in dark chocolate, which uses a lot more cacao per bar, per unit of chocolate. And so you've got an increased increased demand and decreased space that the cacao is growing in.
Okay. So, Matt, if you've ever actually gotten a cacao nib or any of something that's closer to the original plant, you know that you don't really want to eat raw cacao. That would be very upsetting.
Some, a couple of people do. We have some people do.
So a lot of chocolates, the differentiation between chocolate makers is how much cacao they use and what additives they put in.
Yeah, that is so. There's kind of two industries. There's the industrial chocolate industry,
Hershey's,
but even things that you know you would find at like your Whole Foods that you know say organic and look you know like a good chocolate bar. That's still going to be a different experience than doing a craft chocolate bar. So there's all these different varieties of beans, of cacao. And just like coffee or wine, these varieties end up having different flavors. And so what we've strived to do and what a lot of craft chocolate makers strive to do is to sort of open people to this new experience that chocolate's not just this one flavor that we grew up with, you know, as kids, which when you actually go back and kind of think about it, is oftentimes more of a vanilla flavor. Because what industrial chocolate's doing is they're buying pretty low-quality beans that haven't really been processed very well. And then they put a lot of vanilla and other additives in to kind of sugarcoat the
literally
chocolate flavor.
Literally sugarcoat. You're talking about
yeah.
M&M.
Yeah. And, you know, what we're doing is we're stripping that all down. So our single-origin dark chocolate bars are just cacao and organic cane sugar. And so we brought a bar from Madagascar, a bar from Nicaragua, and actually you'll be the first to try the chocolate made with the beans that are actually we were sourcing in the documentary.
During the documentary.
Yeah. And each of these bars ends up having a completely different flavor to it without us doing anything to add any ingredients. And that's just from the different varieties that are in the beans, you know, themselves and how they've been both processed in the country of origin, because there is a pretty complicated fermentation and drying process that happens there in the country, and then how we roast the beans and grind the beans, refine it into actual chocolate.
Is Atlanta a good chocolate place to sell? Or do people
yes.
like their – they do like their
I would,
chocolate here.
I would say absolutely. So Atlanta, you know, it's definitely a very food-centric city, and people are very educated about their food and very interested in where it comes from. So the farm-to-table food trend is alive and thriving in Atlanta, and we see that here in chocolate as well. Because we have our customers come right up to our shop, we get a lot of instant feedback from our customers. And one of the things that Matt and I had hoped for when we first started was that we would have customers that eventually knew exactly what their taste preferences were. So they might say, I only like chocolate from Madagascar, or I only like chocolate from Trinidad. And we're definitely about, I would say about a year into being at Krog Street, we started to see that happen. So, you know, our customers are very educated and very interested.
That is Elaine Reed and Matt Wyant. They're the owners of the Atlanta-based chocolate company, Chocolatl. Matt and Elaine, thank you both so much.
Thank you very
thank you.
Much.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
That's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. When you get a craving for sweetness, what is your go-to treat? Chocolate? Maybe something else. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. Our handle is @OSTTalk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it. There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly